Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Lovely to have you along and to share the news that we have been shortlisted for the Babcock International First Sea Lords Award for the best use of digital media. And if you want to find out why and you've just arrived here, then you need immediately to head over to our YouTube page, our Instagram and TikTok channels to see all of our fabulous video material, as well as going back through the archive of audio episodes where you will find a little bit for everyone. My current favourite video is an animated map that shows where the Mary Celeste was found adrift and silent. And I think that my current favourite audio episode, that was very hard to choose, was on the maritime history of time. Now you may think, ah, longitude, I know all about that. Well, I can tell you there's a hell of a lot more to it than just longitude. Today we're back in our familiar stomping ground of the Second World War. If this is your period of interest, then there's plenty for you to see and hear. In particular, check out the 3D animation we've made of a Japanese aircraft carrier launching its attack at Pearl Harbor. And there are at least 12 audio episodes you can find that are tagged World War II. You can find them and browse the episodes all at snr.org.uk. If you want a general overview of the period, there's a particularly interesting recent podcast with the excellent Paul Kennedy, in which he talks about the transformation of the global order in terms of sea power between 1939 and 1945. Today, however, we are in the North Atlantic and we are hunting the Bismarck. We're talking about the might of the Royal Navy pursuing and destroying Germany's greatest battleship. The ship that on the 24th of May 1941 had sunk the pride of the Royal Navy, HMS Hood. A sinking that left 1,415 of the Hood's crew dead, with only three survivors. The subsequent hunt for and destruction of the Bismarck is one of the greatest tit-for-tat, naval, eye-for-an-eye stories that you'll ever hear. And to help me tell it, I spoke with the brilliant Angus Constam, who spoke to me from his home in Orkney, just a stone's throw from the Royal Navy's great World War II naval base at Scarpa Flow. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. That deeply knowledgeable and natural storyteller, here is Angus. Angus, thank you very much for joining me today.
A pleasure.
So, why did you choose to write about Bismarck? I ask this because people have written about Bismarck before.
Right. It's obviously it's done to death in a way. There's a number of excellent books about it. However, I was fascinated by it really since, I think, as a kid when I saw the Kenneth Moore film. It sort of piqued my interest. But then the fact is, I suppose, living in Orkney or moving back to Orkney, you have Scapa Flow behind you, where was the starting point of the thing, at least from the British side. So that was of interest. And then after my time in the Navy and writing various other things, I I became kind of fascinated by the whole, really, the decision-making process, and all the books I've read about it didn't really cover that in the kind of detail I wanted. It's the space, the time of the Atlantic is the big place. I've gone across it a few times, and there's a lot of ocean out there. So to get a ship to one particular point, to find a ship in the vastness of the Atlantic, has always fascinated me. And there are long delays in signalling, in getting a ship from A to B, so you've got to plan ahead. So it was the decision-making process by the commanders, by Admiral Lutyens on the Bismarck and Admiral Tovey in the Home Fleet in Scapa Flow, and, of course, his deputy, Vice Admiral Holland, that kind of fascinated me. And then then the whole search, it was all part of that huge Lost in the Atlantic thing, which I found utterly fascinating.
Yeah, I like the well, we'll talk about it later, but the fact that she's found by biplanes as well, and it's a kind of a wonderful mixture of the very latest technology and some old pretty ropey stuff, which proves it's still effective. Anyway, let's go back to the beginning. Tell me why Bismarck was built.
Well, the Kriegsmarine started in 1935, taking over from the Reichsmarine. It was the Germans started building increasingly large ships, starting with armoured cruisers like the Graf Spee, the ones we kind of call pocket battleships. There wasn't much of a battleship about them, but they did the job. They were essentially commerce raiders, and the whole German thing about building battleships was an extension of this commerce raiding idea. So from there they went on to the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, which we labelled as battle cruisers. They were really kind of small, fairly light battleships, I suppose. But then they came on to the next step up in July 1936. They laid the keel of the Bismarck, and essentially it was going to be the ultimate commerce raider. The Germans knew that they couldn't take on the Royal Navy in terms of number of ships, but the British ships were fairly elderly. The battleships, they had two battleships that were worth their salt. The rest really weren't, were old survivors of the First War. But they had new ones building. The King George V class of was still just about to come out when it wasn't even coming out then. It came they came in during the war. So you have this fairly small British battleship power of and the Germans thought, right, if we can sneak out, we can do in a far more effective way. There was still, Admiral Raeder was not convinced about the whole U-boat idea as a way of bringing down British commerce. Britain being an island, totally reliant on sea communications, and for her survival, she needed convoys coming in with ships, carrying everything from Spanish onions to bananas to iron ore, everything needed to sustain the population and to fight the war. So by breaking that, could either be done by surface warships on raids, which they did a bit of in the First War, and then in 1939 when the Graf Spee and the Deutschland went out and did that, they were fairly successful. So it was all part of that whole thing. So they weren't trying to match Britain. There was the whole Plan Z thing of building a great fleet with a level of when it would actually could be big enough to take on the Royal Navy, was in about 1945, 1946, or 1949, depending which stage of the whole process you look at. But so Bismarck was very much, though, going to be a commerce raider, but she was going to be the biggest, the best, and the most powerful. And the whole idea was she had the armour, the speed and the guns to outpace any British battleship afloat. And then if she was caught in a fight, then she could stand her ground she had the firepower and the armour to take on anything the British could throw against her.
Yeah. And most prestigious as well. This was really going to be flying the flag for Germany on the high seas.
It was very much a prestige thing. Bismarck and then her sister ship Tirpitz were, when they were launched, were essentially arguably the best battleships in the world. Everyone claims to have the best battleships, the Americans, the Japanese, the British. But Bismarck compare her to the British equivalents, the Rodney and the Nelson, the two Nelson-class battleships. She was much faster. They were showing their age. They were about 20 years old. Bismarck just had the firepower of the guns. They were fairly well matched in armour, the British, yeah, and in firepower. But Bismarck had state-of-the-art optics for her fire control, so her gunnery was going to be accurate. But she was fast and she was reliable and she had an incredible range. So a useful addition. But the whole idea was not to get involved in a stand-up fight, but to use her as a commerce raider. And if she had got loose among Atlantic convoys, she could have had a devastating impact.
Yeah. How did HMS Hood fit into this picture? Because that really turns out to be Bismarck's great foe.
Yes, well, Hood was a lovely ship. She, everyone reckons she was one of the prettiest warships of the age. But her age was long past. She came out, she was a byproduct of the battle cruisers designed in the First World War. She lacked the armour. She had the speed, but she had a reasonable armament. But she hadn't been updated. She was a beautiful ship, a large ship, perfectly designed for showing the flag and having cocktail parties on board. But really not, by 1941, she was not really of a class to take on ships like Bismarck. She lacked the fire control. She lacked she had the speed, but above all, she lacked the armor. Bismarck had had modern croup armor, 12.5-inch main arm belt. Hood had one, but it was much more patchy. She had thick armor in some places over her, what the ship designers would call their vitals, their magazines and the engine spaces. But her weak point was really weak decks. And battle cruisers were designed for speed with great firepower. We know how that went wrong at the Battle of Jutland, because the British lost three of them very quickly. It's just a design that was flawed. She had been updated. She had been had increased armor by 1941, but she still wasn't really a patch on Bismarck.
Well, how did the two meet then? How did the two get to face each other off in the Denmark Strait? What were the manoeuvres that brought them there?
Well, we're back to my fascination with the decision making and the whole thing of getting ships into the right place. The Germans could only break out into the Atlantic through one of four routes. One, the unlikely one between Orkney and Shetland, was really no go, because Scapa Flow was just down the road. The odd, 60 miles between the two of them. I live in Orkney. I've flown to Shetland. It takes no time at all. And it's easily patrolled. So too, in a way, is the gap between Shetland and the Faroes. The British had air bases in Orkney, in Shetland, and in Caithness on the Scottish mainland. So they could fairly easily plug that gap with ships and aircraft. That left two sensible routes. One was the one between Iceland and the Faroes, and the other one was between Iceland and Greenland, the so-called Denmark Straits that you mentioned earlier. So the British had to plug all these gaps, but essentially they had to concentrate on the Faroes-Iceland gap and then the Iceland-Greenland gap. And the last time Admiral Lutyens tried this, he had the battle cruisers Scharnhorst and Eisenhower under his command, and he went through the Faroes Gap, the Faroes Iceland Gap. So that was kind of the likely one. But to cover all bases, Admiral Tovey, the commander of the Home Fleet in Scapa Flow, decided to send his deputy, Vice Admiral Holland, to the Denmark Strait. It was already patrolled by two heavy cruisers, by the cruisers Norfolk and Suffolk. But by sending some firepower, he thought these two ships should be able to stop them. Goodness gracious. One is the Hood, the big, beautiful Hood, the flagship of Vice Admiral Holland. But the other one is the brand new, one of the ones I was talking about, the ships that were just coming out, the King George V class, was Prince of Wales. And she was so new, as was so shown so wonderfully in the film with Kenneth Moore, they were still trying to fix her problems with her gun turrets. She was nothing but teething problems. She had a mouthful of teething problems when she sailed. But again, that's my whole fascination. It's a long way to go from the sort of 700, 800 miles from Scapa Flow to the gap there. So you had to think ahead, and you had to, without knowing where the Germans were, she was spotted in off Bergen. She'd sailed from Gotenhaven in the Baltic, now Gdansk or wherever it is, Gdynia, sorry. And then she made her way to the Grimstadt Fjord just south of Bergen on the 21st of May. She was spotted there by a coastal command reconnaissance plane that afternoon. So the British knew where she was. And at that point, Admiral Tovey had to make his decision about where to deploy his ship. So just after midnight, the next day late on the Wednesday, the 21st, very early in the morning, Thursday, 22nd, Hood and Prince of Wales set out from Scapa Flow through the Hoxha Sound, just about a few hundred yards from my house. It'd been an interesting place to watch them that evening. And essentially, they had to set out with no idea if they were going to go into combat or not. And at the same time, Admiral Tovey had to make sure he plugged the other gaps. And what they tended to do, the British, was to have a tripwire of cruisers, light cruisers, or in the Denmark Strait, heavy cruisers. And then they would pull back, and Admiral Tovey would be kicking around in the background with King George V, his flagship, and with the aircraft carrier Victorious. He would also be able to draw on his deputy, on Vice Admiral Holland, with the Hood and Prince of Wales. So it was like a big chessboard, but played out without any idea where the other people's pieces were.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. And then when they finally met, when Hood and Bismarck met, well, what happened?
Right. Well, the Hood and the Prince of Wales had a destroyer escort. They had been detached to refuel. The British were able to do that in Reykjavik. The Denmark Strait was a fairly narrow channel, made narrower by pack ice on the Greenland side and by mines on the Icelandic side. So once the British figured out that the Germans weren't going to go through the Faroes Gap, Tovey signalled Holland, who was south of Iceland, and said, "Get cracking, get in there by dawn," which is when we expect them to come through. Bismarck was sighted on the 23rd of May at about 7:20 in the evening, and the cruisers Suffolk and Norfolk played sort of cat and mouse game of shadowing her as she ran south through the strait. But all the time they were signalling to Admiral Holland, saying, "Look, this is where they are. You're going to meet them." He kept on increasing the speed of his ships and changing the angle so he'd get in the position to meet them at dawn. So that's what happened. At about 5:30, Bismarck and Prince Eugen, she was accompanied by the heavy cruiser Prince Eugen, and they sighted Hood sighted them, and then the two ships were essentially on parallel courses, roughly about 14-15 miles apart. they then started manoeuvring for the best possible position. And as you know, a battleship, its guns are essentially pointed. The best way is to fire the guns to on the broadside. So you want to be side on to the enemy. That's going to be a problem as you're trying to close the range. So picture it, Bismarck with Prince Eugen in front of her were heading essentially southeast. So was Hood with Prince of Wales behind her. And as the morning wore on, they sighted each other about 5:37. Within about 10 minutes, they've altered course. The range has dropped to almost range to open fire. The range is decreasing steadily. But Holland is still he wants to get to cross the T. He wants to get all his guns firing on the Germans, but only the front of the German ships could fire at him. It's a thing that worked. It was a tactic from the Age of Sail. It still worked in the battleship, in the time of the battleship. It was a classic thing used at Tsushima. The British managed it at Jutland. This was the whole game. But kind of the problem was the Germans knew this too. They kept on jinking their ships. So when the time came, when the two sides started opening fire, at around 5:52, a little after, after 20 minutes essentially of manoeuvring and closing the range, all the German guns could just about fire on the British, especially when at about 5:40, Lütjens turns to starboard to keep the range, keep the battleships apart. This is one of the fascinating things. This applies to people who like it like this from the point of view of the you've seen the film and you like it, but it also appeals to the tech heads who there are books, as you said, everyone's written about this. It's like Jutland. It attracts books analysing each shell and velocity and so on. But on the day, all they could do, the admirals in charge, was to just essentially hope for the best, try to put the ships in the best position. But Admiral Lütjens managed it. Vice Admiral Holland was still trying to manoeuvre. So he opens fire. Bismarck opens fire shortly afterwards. Hood makes the mistake of targeting the leading German ship. He thinks that's a Bismarck. It's actually the Prince Eugen. They look similar in silhouette. It's just one's a lot bigger than the other. Both ships of the British ships started firing. The admiral was ordering them to fire at the lead ship. Fortunately, Captain Kerr of the Prince of Wales decided, right, we're going to target Bismarck. It's the second one. It's the second ship in the line. That's the one we're shooting at. So he was already ignoring orders. At that point, the two sides started manoeuvring, and Admiral Holland decides, right, I'm going to try to turn to port to let all my guns bear. At the moment, only his leading forward guns, the two forward turrets of Hood, the two forward turrets of Prince of Wales, could fire. So he had to turn. But these salvos were winging off about every 30 seconds, quite fast. And imagine it, the range is about 12 miles. There are wonderful pictures of them in action. And one of the Hood firing its guns, taken from the Prince of Wales towards the target. But there's a great one from the Prince Eugen looking at Bismarck with a big gun flash. There's even ones from Prince Eugen showing shell splashes in the distance. You can't really see the ships from the naked eye at that range, but you can...
What sort of range were they firing at?
You're speaking about 12 miles. So at that time, a shell takes about 45 seconds to travel. So you've kind of got to think ahead. So they're turning. It's just before 6 o'clock. Bismarck fires at 5:59. Bismarck fires three salvos in quick succession with her 15-inch guns. That's 8 15-inch guns. A lot of explosives heading towards towards the British ships. He's targeting the lead German ship. So too is Prince Eugen. They're both battering Hood. Just under a minute later, one of the shell Hood is starting to turn so all her guns can bear. She's a little ahead of the Prince of Wales, and this salvo catches her stern. And remember, I was saying she was a battle cruiser. She was not well protected. Her deck was her weak point, her Achilles heel, and these shells found it. They plunged through her after deck. They found the shipwreck fairly recently and were able to analyse a lot of the damage. So we can tell what happened to some extent, but nobody in either side predicted what happened at that moment, because Hood essentially blew apart. It blew up an after magazine, which blew the stern off the ship. In the bridge, the captain and the admiral had no idea what was going on. They were still forging ahead. The forward guns were still firing when the stern of the ship had been blown off. On the Prince of Wales, they just saw this huge column of flame and an explosion, and the best they could do was they were still firing, but they had to jink their ship around the burning wreckage. So essentially, there's this cataclysmic moment, and then Hood starts to sink, and she goes down, and as we know, she sinks very quickly. There were three survivors.
Three out of a crew of how many?
Three out of a crew of about 1,500.
Yeah.
So quite a colossal loss of life. But the important thing for the Germans is that they'd taken out that one ship. They didn't even want to fight. They would have sooner sneaked out into the Atlantic without any confrontation. But so it was full points to the British for being there, but not so good because their ships weren't up to the task. However, and Prince of Wales, she turned away onto a new course, and she was still firing it at Bismarck as this was going on. And she was actually managing to hit her. This is kind of a crucial thing. But now by about 6:03, the range had dropped to 8 miles. And a salvo from the Prince of Wales straddled the Bismarck and scored a hit. It didn't seem to do any damage at the time, though. Bismarck by now turned her guns on the Prince of Wales, and she was hit badly. The British battleship, the captain was stunned. The bridge was turned into a charnel house with a direct hit. Only two of the bridge staff survived, and surprisingly, the captain did. But the British battleship was being really pummeled. Half of her guns, remember saying there was, she still had workmen on board trying to fix them. Half of them weren't working, so it was just a very one-sided engagement. And eventually, at 6:05, the captain of Prince of Wales decided he was being outfought, and he radar was being knocked out. His aircraft, spotter aircraft, had been destroyed. His guns were malfunctioning. He'd been badly hit. His bridge had been taken out. So he turned away and broke off the fight. So that left Bismarck and Prince Eugen clear to slip into the Atlantic. And ideally, they'd like to shake off any pursuit, get lost in the vastness of the Atlantic, and then choose a juicy convoy to attack. However,
worst of all scenarios. So not only have they escaped, but they've also sunk the Hood.
They've sunk the Hood, yes. And Hood was the sort of poster child of the Royal Navy for the whole interwar period, showing the flag in just about everywhere. Everyone knew the Hood. So it was a huge morale boost for the Germans, and conversely, it was a catastrophe, a PR catastrophe, and a catastrophic loss of life for the British. She might have been outdated, but she was still a very prestigious ship. So it was an incredible victory.
Were they careful on not breaking the news to the public? How did that happen in the UK?
The Admiralty would have liked to been fairly cautious about it, but unfortunately they had to tell the fleet. Tovey had to be told. He was radioed by the commander of the shadowing British cruisers first. So the news spread to him. The news spread to London, to Whitehall, and they basically had to. It would have got out, so they had to. It was the pride of the fleet, so they had to fess up to it fairly quickly. At the same time, the Germans were already radioing the news back to Berlin, so it's not something you could have quietened down. However, what the crucial thing though in the battle is, Bismarck was damaged. That two 14-inch shells fired from the Prince of Wales had damaged her, and crucially, one had hit one of her oil tanks at the waterline in a fairly unprotected, one of the few unprotected parts of her hull, and oil was leaking out. So Admiral Lutyens then had the decision to make: do I continue with my raid on shipping, or do I head back to port? So it may have been a huge, dramatic victory for the incredible victory for the Germans, but it came at a cost that would eventually cause the loss of the Bismarck.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah, and then a massive scramble. So the British are not—they're not anywhere really near where this has happened. So they need to get there as quickly as possible. And I mean, the whole operation of trying to hunt down the Bismarck seems almost impossible at the start, doesn't it?
It is. It's a vast ocean. However, the British had a huge advantage. They had these two cruisers, Norfolk and Suffolk. Suffolk had a decent radar set. Remember, radar was just coming in, so fairly basic systems. But Suffolk had the more advanced one there. So these two cruisers, followed by the limping Prince of Wales, shadowed Bismarck and Prince Eugen as they ran south into the Atlantic and sent out sent messages to Admiral Tovey, who was closing with from he was a fair distance, about 300 or 400 miles at this point, over to the east, but was approaching with King George V, the battlecruiser Repulse, and the carrier Victorious. So the first thing they do is they draw close, and the British send out attempt an air attack with the aircraft from the Swordfish you were speaking about, almost ridiculously outdated biplanes, and they attempt an air attack. Making it one of the first such attacks in the open sea in history. It didn't work, but the pilots were green. The pilots didn't expect to be thrown into combat so quickly. The ship was fairly new in the service, so were her airmen. But the only thing old about it was her aircraft. But these ships ran south, and the next... So Admiral Lutyens has to shake off his pursuers if he's going to achieve anything. His first job, he manages to jink around there. He jinks from side to side. He tries to fire He tries everything to shake off the pursuers, including turning his ship and firing on the British cruisers or the Prince of Wales. But eventually, they fall back to the extremities of radar range. And first thing he does is he manages to, without the British noticing, he manages to detach Prince Eugen by turning Bismarck around to threaten his pursuers. And the cruiser Prince Eugen disappears off into the Atlantic and is lost to the British. But that evening, or rather in the early hours of the next morning, Bismarck manages to do the same thing with his with the pursuers and escapes by turning around, by fooling the British that he's going one way and they think he's going, they cover him going the other direction. He disappears off. He does a full circle and he heads off into the Atlantic. But he, this time, because of his fuel, because he is leaking fuel, he reckons he doesn't have enough for the raid he was planning. So he decides, I'm going to head back to one of the ports, like Saint-Nazaire on the French Atlantic coast. So
there can't have been many which would actually have been able to help the Bismarck. I mean, we're looking at a very large port facility. So, I mean, if the British worked out that he was going to get help, they could kind of narrow down where he was heading for.
Yes, exactly. They know she could head to Brest, she could head to somewhere like that, Saint-Nazaire. But the trouble is, she's got the British are looking for a needle in the haystack. They lost contact with her during that night or early that morning. So Bismarck is out there. They have no idea where. Tovey has the job at sea from his little bridge of coordinating all of this, this search. So he's drawing in ships from all over. He pulls the battleship Prince Rodney off a convoy. He gets the Admiralty to radio Vice Admiral Somerville in charge of Force H based in Gibraltar to send up ships. That means he's got the carrier Ark Royal coming to help him. He's got his own carrier Victorious. But then the big problem is he's looking for the ship, doesn't know where it is, doesn't know which way it went, and he's running out of fuel. All these ships have been to sea, they gobble up fuel, and they have to put into port at some point. So as Bismarck's heading, is her actions are dictated by fuel and her fuel leak, so are the British. Covey has to keep going until he runs out of fuel, and then, before he runs out of fuel, Churchill was actually suggesting, we could tow them in. Can you imagine towing a battleship through the Atlantic into port? But that was the feeling at the time. We have to get the Bismarck because it's just crucial. It's a matter of national pride.
Yeah, and then it falls to these antiquated biplanes who just somehow luckily spot her.
It falls to these antiquated biplanes. Yes, I mean you've probably seen them in museums. The Fleet Air Museum, for instance, has one. And you just look at this thing and thinking, this is out of a... This should be flown
it's like
by...
like a kite.
it's a huge thing that should have been flown by Biggles. But they essentially put the Italian fleet out of action in November 1940 at the Taranto raid. So they worked. They did the job. And imagine this. Bismarck is heading towards the French coast, heading towards the southeast, but it's like a huge chessboard. You've got convoys going all over the place. Victorious, the carrier, and Prince of Wales have already broken off due to lack of fuel. Admiral Tovey, in his flagship King George V, is heading is somewhere behind Bismarck. He has no idea where Bismarck is. And coming up from the south is Force H, Vice Admiral Somerville's Force H, which includes the carrier Ark Royal. So all these chess pieces are on the board, but the trouble is nobody knows where the other person's king or queen or main chess piece is until, almost by fluke, she's found by... They're sending out search planes from Britain at a great rate of knots, going out in the Atlantic. They're coming back empty. They can't find anything. And then on Monday the 26th, which is 2 days after the Battle of the Denmark Straits, at 10:30, Bismarck is spotted by a Catalina flying plane sent from Ireland. So they know where she is at long last. But they had a little clue earlier, because that night Admiral Lutyens had to radio his superiors and say, look, I'm heading back to the French ports, come support me. So that was kind of a stupid thing to do in a way, but because it gave his rough position away. They knew he wasn't heading towards America. They knew he wasn't heading towards the Azores. The British now knew roughly which quadrant of the of the Atlantic he was in. So you've got these things moving in. It was clear by now, though, that Tovey wasn't going to catch up. So there might be chess pieces, but they were too far behind to do anything. The only one that might have a chance of catching in and to close in on the prey was Force H. And that all came to after Bismarck was sighted, it soon became clear that the only way that could be done was by an airstrike. Vice Admiral Somerville had his own flagship was a battle cruiser, which was no match for Bismarck. So the only thing he could do was use these antiquated swordfish from Ark Royal. They did a first airstrike, which launched in the afternoon of the 26th of May. It didn't work, because by that time Somerville had a cruiser shadowing the Bismarck, and it was attacked instead of Bismarck herself, a British cruiser. It doesn't say much for aircraft recognition, so the crew of the poor Sheffield couldn't even fire back when they were being attacked by their own people. So a very chastened airman returned to refuel and rearm. And that's the other thing about this story. It's the last roll of the dice. By the following morning, they'd be within air range of the Luftwaffe air bases in France. They'd have a line of U-boats shadowing them, protecting Hood as she ran home. So the last chance the British had were to stop her that night. And sure enough, at 7:20, they launched an airstrike from the Ark Royal, headed southeast, found Bismarck and attacked her. So this airstrike goes in about 8 o'clock, and amazingly, and these antiquated biplanes have a torpedo. They're attacking at a ridiculous speed of about 80 miles an hour. Imagine that. And the Germans couldn't, the story is, the German anti-aircraft defences couldn't even cope with their fire control systems. Never expected a plane to be that slow. So the flak was sort of bursting ahead of most of the planes. The one I feel sorry for is the guy in the back, the sort of rear gunner, who just has to stand there in this little open cockpit, watching all the stuff come at him and this great battleship appearing closer. So they attack
her. What an extraordinary moment.
Yeah, exactly. And they attack her from all sides. They take turns. It's almost impossible to coordinate these things. But again, the last roll of the last roll of the dice is a torpedo hits Bismarck in the stern, and she's hit twice. One just bounces off her underwater armor, essentially, but the other hits her in the stern, and it jams her rudder, and that is the crucial thing.
Right.
So night sets. Sheffield behind, the poor ship that was shot up by its own airmen, reports to Vice Admiral Somerville that the Bismarck is circling. It's, what the heck is it doing? It's turning. It's kind of going in lazy circles. And that's the moment they realised they'd got her.
Yeah. What an extraordinary moment. And then it's a matter of finishing her off. How do you go about finishing off an enormous battleship?
Well, it's also about morale. Because that night she was shadowed by a bunch of destroyers, Captain Vine's destroyers, including a Polish one, the Piorun. And they harass her with torpedo attacks throughout the night. The trouble is, your fire control's a bit messed up, because you can't, if your ship keeps turning, you can't make calculations to engage ships. And so they're firing their secondary guns. It's essentially, there's very little chance of them actually getting close enough to do a torpedo hit on her. But it keeps the gun crews at stations all night. So just before midnight, Lütjens radios Germany and says, look, I'm in a hopeless situation. My speed's down to 7 knots because they've tried everything. They've sent, they've stopped and taken divers down. They've had damage control parties trying to freeze it, but they can't unjam this rudder. It's limiting the speed of the ship. It's almost impossible to steer. They're trying to use their engines to steer the ship. So they kind of make a sort of crazily sort of slug-like course across the Atlantic. There's almost no chance of getting to port. So by dawn, by 7 a.m, Lütjens sends a final signal to Germany. Hitler says, you know, everyone's proud of you. Fight to the death. Hitler loved people fighting to the death, it seems. And but there's nothing else you do. You can't do anything else. You can't surrender a thing like Bismarck. But at 8:45, Bismarck was finally sighted. But the thing about all this is it allowed Tovey to catch up. And he was running on empty. It was like coming down the motorway and you're desperately looking for a petrol station and your needle's on well on the red bit. That was exactly the state of Rodney and King George V, his two battleships.
Right. Oh, no.
So even that is the last roll of the dice. He reckoned he had until about 9... maybe 10 that morning before he had to break off and refuel, Bismarck or not. So, and they sight him at 8:45. At 8:47, Rodney opens fire with her 16-inch guns, followed a minute later by King George V. Bismarck starts firing back, but of course her damage control is so messed up it's hard for her to hit anything. But the British start what essentially a very clinical destruction of Bismarck. They get the range, the shells start slamming in, the range is closing steadily, and it's essentially bit by bit destruction. Yeah, she might have been the pride of the German fleet, she might have fantastic armour, but the first hit at 8:59 from Rodney, a 16-inch shell. You can't do much with a 16-inch shell. It's a huge lump of explosives. It hits her main gunnery director, and after that, it was just a turkey shoot. 2 minutes later, the forward turrets had been knocked out, the after gunnery director had been knocked out, and then it was just fires were starting to break out all over the deck. They weren't penetrating her hull, but they were just knocking out her ability to fight and to do anything. With you can't move around a ship whose decks are on fire. Your morale had already been reduced to when the crew realised they weren't getting home. So it was just a matter of finishing her off. And that became a very clinical gunnery exercise, which lasted about 40 minutes until Bismarck's guns were finally silenced at about 9:30 that morning.
And with her crew on board still, I think it's important to make this point. It's not like a passenger ship which has got, plenty of lifeboats, and you can kind of carefully disembark your crew. I mean, the Germans are still on board, and they're getting absolutely pounded.
Yeah, well, the lifeboats, her ship's boat. She had lots of ship's boats. She had some very, very lovely looking ship's boats, but they're all matchwood by this stage, or burning merrily. So you've got a ship who essentially she can't steer. She can only manoeuvre at 7 knots. Her guns are knocked out. She's got 2,065 men on board. A lot of casualties by this stage. You've got accounts of people jammed in their turrets and can't get out. People burning to death. It's just horrendous. So and one of the first hits probably knocks out the bridge. Captain Lindemann of the Bismarck and then Admiral Lütjens, who just a day before was sort of rubbing his hands, thinking, right, we're gonna change the course of the naval war here. Both of them were killed on the bridge. So you've got this. So it's down to the executive officer was killed. You get an engineering officer is starting to set scuttling charges. By this time, it's got 9 o'clock. Tovey's got no option. He silences the ship. There's nothing else he can do. He decides he's finishing her off with the torpedoes. He sends in a cruiser, the Dorsetshire, which has just fairly newly arrived. And she fires a salvo of two torpedoes at 10:24, followed by other ones about 6 minutes later. And that's enough to finally sink Bismarck. But did it? Were the torpedoes the thing that sank her, or was it the fact they were already scuttling her? But all those men who had to jump out of the ship, once they gave the orders to abandon ship, they landed up in the water. It was fairly, it wasn't a storm. It wasn't particularly rough seas, but it was fairly choppy out there. Huge swell, and covered in burning oil. So these survivors bobbing around in the water. And this time the British close in and try to rescue whoever they could. But it's not an easy process. You're scrambling nets are put down. You've got to take people out of the water on scrambling nets. The destroyed Maori closed in. The cruiser Dorsetshire. There were recovering people. Then Dorsetshire thought they spotted a periscope in the water. So they had to break off. Captain Martin of Dorsetshire pulled the ship away. Leaving men in the water. Maori then tried to find the U-boat, and then their main priority was not the rescue of the German survivors, but was to save their own crew. So they had very little option but to break off. So ships had been there, were trying to rescue them. In the end, one of the senior survivor, an officer called Mullum Reckenberg, estimated about 800 people were left behind in the water.
Really?
The 116 survivors were rescued by the British ships, one of which died on board Dorsetshire from his wounds. A few more were left alive the next morning to be rescued by a German U-boat, U-75, and a German weather ship, which had closed in. But essentially, the rest had drowned, had gone down with the ship, or just succumbed in the water, like so many sailors did after the ship sank.
Yeah, not a very shocking moment. Did it have a significant effect on the path of the maritime war?
It didn't. It had a huge effect on the Kriegsmarine, because the crew of the Bismarck had paid the ultimate price for this sort of challenge to British, both British sea power, but also the whole idea of using surface ships for commerce raiders. After that, it was all over to the U-boats to do the job. To fight the Battle of the Atlantic. That idea was basically scrapped. Hitler had no real use for his surface ships anymore, he stationed them in the Baltic and in Norway. It was only when the Arctic convoy started taking off shortly afterwards that they had a purpose, which was harassing the Arctic convoys. So it was very much a scaling back of the whole German fleet after that. It couldn't do its the job it had been built to do, which was to break Britain by destroying her maritime trade.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and Angus, thank you very much indeed for sharing it with us today.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, my turn to ask of you a favour. If you're listening on iTunes, please leave us a review. If you do so, I promise I will read it out. It helps a huge deal, as the more reviews we get, the easier it is for people to find us, and therefore the more we can teach people about maritime history. Don't forget that this podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation. And you can find the History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk. And make sure to check out their latest project, Maritime Innovation in Miniature. Just Google it, Maritime Innovation in Miniature, and you will see the world's best ship models filmed with the latest camera equipment. It's mind-blowing.
The Society for Nautical Research you can find at snr.org.uk, and that's where you can join up. It's a fabulous way to meet people, to find out all about the maritime past from the world's very best maritime historians. And if you're a full member, you get to come to our annual dinner on board HMS Victory or HMS Warrior, and that is something you will never, ever forget.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.